Chief Housing Officer from the Executive Office of Elder Affairs. I see a whole bunch of people joining, so I'm just going to give it a sec while everybody gets situated. Thanks everybody for joining with us on this kind of gray, humid day. I hope you are doing well and staying safe. Today we're going to talk about an important topic, which is how do we move forward? How do we unpause the things that were paused for COVID-19 in a safe and healthy way? And we're going to hear from two agencies about what they are doing and share some resources and hear from you all as well. So again, I'm Emily Cooper. I work at the Executive Office of Elder Affairs. I want to thank Leading Age Massachusetts for supporting this effort and providing a safe space for us to Zoom platform for us to do this. And with that, I'm actually going to turn it over to Lynn. I'm sure you are all Zoom experts, but she's going to make sure you know how to ask questions and things like that as we go on in this call.
Good afternoon, everybody. Just a couple of quick things. The default for coming into this meeting is to be muted. So if you would like to make a comment or ask a question, you will need to unmute yourself. For those on the computer, you do that by clicking on the little microphone icon, typically on the bottom left-hand side of your screen. For those on the phone, you'll want to press *6 in order to unmute yourself. In both cases, we would ask after you have made your comment or asked your question if you would remute yourself to reduce background noise. So again, for those on the computer, it's clicking the little microphone icon, and for those on the phone, it's pressing *6. We will also be monitoring the chat box for those of you on your computers. So if you have a question or would like to make a comment but don't have the opportunity to join the conversation, we would ask that you just put your question or comment in the chat box. For those of you who are on the phone and aren't able to access the chat box, you're able to send me an email. My email address is lmonaghan@leadingagema.org. I think that is all.
Thanks so much, Lynn. This is really a partnership between the Executive Office of Elder Affairs and other state housing agencies. So I just want to give them a minute to say hello. So David Ng is on from Mass Housing.
Thanks, Emily. As we say every week, because it's true, thank you so much for all the work that you all are doing every day to keep our residents safe and healthy. And please don't hesitate to reach out if we can be of any assistance, if you have any questions or need any resources. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. And Department of Housing and Community Development, Amy Stightley.
Hello, everyone. Welcome again. I want to thank everyone, as Dave did, for participating, and thank Kim and Leslie for sharing your practices, because there is no perfect way to reopen. And so thanks for sharing your advice so that other people can learn.
And we're also partnering with CDAC. So Sarah Barkin.
Thank you, Emily. Hi, everybody. Welcome. It's great to see you all here. I've been learning so much from these calls every week, and I know you have too. At CDAC, we do a lot of work in the supportive housing space, but we were actually founded over 40 years ago through legislation filed by then State Representative Mel King as a provider of financing and technical assistance to those in the community development sector or community development corporations. And while we may not always think of CDCs and now we're talking about development CDCs as opposed to healthcare CDC. We may not always think of CDCs as providers of supportive housing to our elders. In fact, some of our CDCs are real leaders in that space. And so I'm very excited to hear what Leslie has to say about the work ongoing at Madison Park. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Sarah. Excuse me, and everybody. This is really a partnership that has a couple of different components. So in addition to these weekly calls, we do have a listserv with about 400 people on it. If you want to join the listserv, you can send an email to seniorhousingcovid19 senior@mass.gov. I'll say it one more time, and I'm sure someone will put it in the chat room. It's seniorhousingcovid19@mass.gov. Also, if you have any questions, any resources you want to share, anything you're struggling with, any good stories you want to share, feel free to email us. That email is, we work with the other state housing agencies to get back to you and try and figure out an answer or get you an information that might be useful. So again, seniorhousingcovid19@mass.gov. So today we are lucky to have with us two agencies that are we really appreciate the fact because they are leaders and trying to think about and share what does it mean to, quote, open up, right? So most senior housing, most housing in general has shut down in some way because of COVID-19. That might be restricting visitors. It might be shutting down groups and community rooms. It might be even moving furniture out of laundry rooms. Some places have gone as far as supplying meals or emptying garbage for people. Really, it's a different way of doing business. And as the governor has and the state has moved to slowly and cautiously reopen other sectors of the society, the question is, what does that mean for property managers, resident service coordinators, owners of affordable housing, particularly those that are serving vulnerable seniors? So we're honored to have with us today. First, we're going to hear from Leslie Reed. Leslie is the CEO of Madison Park Community Development Corporation, or Madison Park CDC, as Sarah was talking about, located in Boston. And she's going to talk about what they're doing. And then we're going to hear from Kim Brooks from Hebrew Senior Life, that works in many areas across the state in many different type of housing settings. She is the COO of Senior Housing. And then we're going to take questions. I know you're going to have a ton of them. We actually have some resources that both Hebrew Senior Life has shared, and then some of you on the phone have been proactively sending us things, your phasing plans and things like that. We'll get that out to all of you so that as you can look at them and see what works best for your housing. So Leslie, I'm going to turn it over to you to speak for a few minutes about what you've been doing, if you want to unmute yourself.
Okay. So here I am. First of all, thank you so much for welcoming myself and Madison Park to this space. It feels like a heavy burden, and I'm honored to carry it to kind of represent the interests of some of the community development corporations that are serving seniors in affordable housing across the city of Boston. You know, as private affordable housing owners, some CDCs have developed age-restricted housing, but we also have a significant amount of housing that does serve seniors. So again, thank you for welcoming me to this space. You know, I just want to take a moment to just acknowledge that, you know, Madison Park was founded, we'll be 55 next year, and over the course of those 55 years, we've developed over 1,500 units of affordable housing. And we operate that housing in partnership with third-party property managers. So I want to take a minute to acknowledge Wynn Residential, Trinity Management, Peabody Properties, and Maloney Properties as our key partners in delivering services to our residents under normal times, and even more so during these challenging times. I want to acknowledge that the site managers, the maintenance staff, and the resident service coordinators, without diminishing first responders, I just want to acknowledge them as frontline staff because they really are in contact with our residents on a day-to-day basis. Prior to this, and even more so during this situation. So our model is that we do have third-party property managers, and we have a two-fold approach to delivering services to all our residents and specifically seniors. And that involves property management and resident service coordinators, in addition to Madison Park specific programs that are coordinated with residents and resident service coordinators. So, you know, during COVID, I think the point of this conversation is to talk about reopening, like, and I'm trying to understand what that means. I don't know yet, but maybe I could just tell you a little bit of our where we are now and where we're thinking about going. So where we are now is that property management staff are actually returning to our sites to be physically present. specifically at Madison Park Village, which is our flagship development and includes 131 unit age restricted property called Smith House. So those property managers and resident service coordinators are returning to the office. And also, until about 2 weeks ago, maintenance staff were only available for emergency responses, and they're starting to return more generally in order to do more routine and preventative maintenance. So that's kind of where we are, but let's talk for a minute about programming. And I just want to say that I'm relatively new to Madison Park. I started as the CEO about 6 months ago in November. And so I just want to take a moment to acknowledge Jean Panato and Russ Tanner, who really kind of led the thinking about how we manage private affordable housing and deliver services to seniors. So they were really the lead thinkers in our redevelopment of the Smith House property, which I mentioned, which was completed about 2 years ago. And that included a significant expansion and design of common areas, both at the entry of the property on the ground floor where residents enter. So we have both internal spaces and a patio. We also have a gorgeous 12th floor, which has stunning views of downtown. I'd love to welcome you all there in person at some point, but also reprogramming that space. And the idea was, as part of the rehabilitation, to create spaces for services to, you know, engage seniors, deliver services, you know, and have contact with them. So during COVID, it's been really devastating because we've had to close down those common areas that we spent so much investment in. And that includes things like, painful things like, pulling out the furniture that we like lovingly selected in partnership with, you know, the residents of the buildings to discourage gathering in common areas. It includes security policies that limit visitors. It has included also the cessation of a lot of the programming we were doing in the building. And, you know, since COVID, what we've been doing is wellness checks. We are really lucky to be in a partnership with Boston Medical Center. They provide licensed nursing staffing and kind of health navigators that coordinate with our resident service coordinators. So as we're doing wellness checks, we have a range of resources to support that. We've also been conducting updated resident needs assessments during the shutdown. We've greatly expanded food distribution. It turns out that our seniors were food unstable before COVID, and of course that's aggravated it. So we've actually expanded that programming to increase the frequency of deliveries and include some hot meal deliveries with other program partners. We've been lucky enough to partner with Tufts Health Plan to be able to deliver care packages that include PPE, masks, hand sanitizers, and other things. And as I mentioned, BMC continues to work with at least 62 of our seniors in this 131 unit development during COVID. So that's kind of where the programming that we've been able to manage during COVID, and almost 100% of that has been kind of remote and not in person. Of course, that's challenging. Also, I wanted to share that I just checked with the property management staff, and we've only had 5 confirmed cases of COVID in our age-restricted property. So I can't say that we're considered kind of like a hotspot. But I do want to just mention and raise the issue that I know the property management, resident services, and program staff are concerned that we're not fully informed of all the cases. Those are the confirmed cases. And I know that we're really struggling with improving our involvement with tracing as we think about reopening, because we're not fully confident that we have a good handle on exposure and you know, infection, because we just don't have access to the, you know, public health information and tracing information. We're not being advised when our residents are exposed. And so that's one of our major concerns in terms of restarting our programming. The other major concern that we've been discussing is making progress towards delivering on-site testing on a regular basis, not just one time, but some kind of routine on-site testing. So as we consider reinstituting programs, those feel like the two biggest concerns that we have that we want to get our arms around before we really feel comfortable safely re-engaging in person with our residents. So again, being more engaged with public health agencies on tracing and also being able to confidently deliver routine and safe on-site testing to our residents. And we feel with those components, we would be in a much better position to implement, you know, restarting our programming. So the programming that we're thinking about restarting, conditioned on those two things I said, is one of the things that we're doing is we have reached out to Whittier Street Health Center, who has been a partner in supporting senior peer health leaders in the past who do health programming in the property, but to expand that relationship to see if they can do some mobile testing on site for our residents. We're continuing to expand and implement additional hot meal delivery. We would really like to restart a walking program called Jolly Walkers, where we engage a significant number of our seniors in getting outside and you know, enhancing their mobility. We've also had a longstanding partnership with Northeastern University to provide on-site fitness classes. So that's some of the programming that we would like to reinstitute. One of the really important and long-term projects that we have been planning and have been implementing, actually with a lot of support from Two Life Communities, is a wellness center that includes exercise equipment, fitness equipment, and is staffed by a licensed physical therapist. So we're planning that. We have a job description to hire a person. We're ordering the equipment, and we're waiting again to figure out how we can safely reopen and invite our seniors into that space. And we're also working with a number of community partners to continue to enhance and expand our technology and instruction to seniors. So before COVID, we had weekly classes for seniors to enhance their utilization of technology to assist with socialization and accessing services and programming. So we're also really focused on how to reinstitute doing that face-to-face. So, you know, we were doing great work, we're on hold, and I feel like for us, our real challenge is, again, being more confident about the tracing of cases and offering testing to residents is a critical benchmark to our ability to start to reinstitute this programming that I've talked about in person. One other thing that I didn't mention, and that we're having a conversation as a staff actually tomorrow, is we have a number of community gardens that are highly utilized by our seniors as well. So that's another program that is kind of on hold pending a better understanding of how we can ensure that we have the information to create plans that you know, safely restart in-person programming.
Thanks, Leslie. That was actually really helpful. And some of the things I hadn't thought about, like the community gardens, the walking clubs, and how do you start thinking about that? There have been some notes put in the comment section. So I just want to flag, we will be talking just before we end about some legislation that we mentioned last time around reporting laws that have been passed. So I don't want to ignore that, but I just want you to know. Somebody did ask, is there a plan for on-site ongoing testing at affordable housing sites for the elderly? There is guidance that got put out by the command center that I will put a link to in the chat which just says how people can sort of, when testing is needed and how to arrange for that. And so I'll put that in the text as a link. But I'm gonna do that while, oh, actually it's already there. Thank you, Ben Stone. So there is information that got posted about testing. There is not a program like for nursing facilities or assisted livings, but there's some information about how you might want to arrange something for your building. So I'm going to turn it over to Kim now to talk about what Hebrew Senior Life is doing, and then we'll take questions and revisit this reporting law as well. So Kim, take it away.
Sure, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to talk with everyone today. It's good to see everyone's faces. You know, I appreciate that we all represent communities of different types and sizes, and you know, Hebrew Senior Life is a big organization. It's been around for 118 years, and you know, we have a lot of different service lines. But today I'm going to focus on our independent living communities, and most particularly our affordable housing sites. We have three different communities of affordable senior housing that are home to 1,000 seniors. And then our little bit broader than that senior living part of the business also includes two continuing care retirement communities. And I agree with Leslie, you know, I wish there was a great roadmap out there. We certainly don't claim to be opening experts, but I will say we started early, unfortunately, with cases in a couple of our buildings. So, you know, we're maybe a little earlier on the cycle, so we've been at it for a while now. So happy to share all the resources that we're using if those are helpful and applicable to your organizations. Just for a little context, across all five of those senior living communities, which are home to 1,700 residents, we've had 63 confirmed cases. Most of those have actually been in one of our continuing care retirement communities that has a skilled nursing unit, and so we saw a lot of volume there. But the other is the Jack Satter House, which is all affordable housing up in Revere, and you know, we are in a hot spot up there. We were ourselves, and Revere and Chelsea, as I'm sure you've heard, are really challenging areas. So of those 63 confirmed cases, we've had 24 deaths and 39 recoveries. So on the good news front, our recovery number is higher than our death number as of right now. So, you know, Jack Satter House, again, just for a little context, you know, because we had case activity there early and it came on fast, we worked with the city of Revere to go into a full emergency order quarantine. Every resident, you know, 285 residents living completely behind closed doors, and had to overnight convert all of our operations to complete quarantine operations. And after we did that, and, you know, we put in a call center to call people every day, we converted, you know, everything you can imagine, we realized that we wanted to actually take that action proactively across all of our senior living communities. So over the course of the next 5 days, we put all five of those communities into a self-imposed shelter in place and converted all the operations to complete quarantine. So, you know, while I know we've all, you know, every community's got different stages of how far you shut down, I think some of the same opening principles apply. So, you know, just to share with you, after weeks of having 1,700 people behind their apartment doors, we were anxious to get opening, get people moving again. A lot of physical and mental health decline, certainly, despite all of the connection and programming that we're trying to deliver remotely through that time. So we've taken a, you know, after, we're also trying to coordinate across all of our communities, and they don't all look the same and feel the same. So it's actually been different within our own organization, the way we've opened. But we realized early on that we needed kind of a guiding principle document and a consistent approach. So I've shared all these resources. I know Allison will start posting things on the chat line, and then we, and our link to our website where we have it all as well. But you know, we created a guiding principles document really for ourselves, but then we ended up sharing it through communications with family and residents, that just kind of lays out the way we were approaching the opening. So, you know, taking it slow, trying to stay behind the state, trying to be mindful of what's happening in each of our locales that we have communities in, not being first in that case, And then, you know, picking items that we can add back that allow for distancing and mask use, trying to utilize our outside spaces as best we can, really creating a culture of accountability among residents. And while we're doing everything we can to support, you know, all of these safe practices and safe operations, we're really delivering a strong message to residents that we need their partnership and we need them to be accountable to themselves and to their community. And that the actions that they take, you know, if they choose to go to the grocery store when we've created an on-site grocery operation that we'll deliver to them, and we've added meals and we've, you know, done all these things to eliminate their need to go to the grocery store, that's a major decision they're making that impacts not only them, but the entire community. And then similarly, as Leslie talked about, you know, ideally we would have a testing and contact tracing strategy that goes with it. We do our own very informal contact tracing. And, you know, testing, we do not have a comprehensive testing plan. We are working with some physicians at Brigham and Women's Hospital who are actually approaching it as a research study, which will allow a lot of flexibility in the testing. And so we're hoping to be kind of the testing site for them where we can roll out a combination of the viral test and the antibody test, and then some surveillance testing for both residents and staff. So as soon as we can get going with that, we're really pushing hard to move that quickly so that it aligns with our opening and that it can help inform and be part of this comprehensive strategy. And as soon as we have more on that, absolutely we'll share that. So we also felt like we needed some actual tools to get a little more concrete about how we were gonna open. And I know some of my colleagues from Hebrew Senior Life are on this call and created some of these documents. So it's been a joint effort across all of our leadership team at each of the sites. So every community has a timeline, and we've laid that timeline out, not in phases like the state, because we were very worried that people would get married to the phase and what the governor's doing and, you know, the timeline, and we're trying to be a little slower than that. So we kind of went with first, next, and later. And so, you know, we have a bunch of things that we're trying to do at the beginning, and then we're layering in over time, and we're not putting specific timelines on each item. We're also, you know, we keep modifying that timeline based on how the first things, how well they go or not. And then we developed a kind of a risk mitigation strategy. So every item, every part of our business, every component was assigned a risk score, low, medium, or high. And so in this COVID world, you know, how risky is that item? And then we look at it and say, what are the, you know, 3, 5, 10 things we could do to mitigate that risk and reduce that risk? And if we can come up with a plan that gets that risk from, say, high to low, then we get to turn that item back on. And so certainly a lot goes into that risk mitigation planning, everything from, you know, changing around furniture to infection control practices to, you know, all the things that you can imagine, I'm sure some of you are doing to try to bring that risk down. We then turn back on as many high impact items as we can that we're able to bring the risk down on. So part of that risk assessment is also, is it a high impact item to the resident? Things like, you know, wellness and fitness and, you know, being able to move around. Is it a high impact item to us as a business? Laundry was a very expensive endeavor for us. We took over the laundry of all of our residents so that they were not going to laundry rooms. So certainly anxious to turn that back on when we felt we could do so safely. And then also not just looking at the individual impact of each item, but the cumulative effect. You know, if we turn back on the mail, the laundry, you know, visitors, and all of a sudden you have all these people converging all over the place, there's cumulative impact that could work against us. So I know Allison will, you know, and we'll make sure we share all those if they're helpful for you. They're very basic Excel spreadsheets and, you know, Word documents that we're just kind of putting together on the fly to help shape our thinking around this. We get into specifics, some of the things that we've opened first, move outs. We have done that. I know there were some questions earlier about, you know, safe move outs and turnovers and move ins. We've started to bring vendors back very carefully, monitored very carefully, but getting our apartments turned over and prepped for move ins. a lot of walking programs, much more organized walking than we've ever done before. Outdoor fitness, we haven't opened our fitness centers, but we've opened our fitness programs, and we're doing those, again, utilizing the outdoors whenever we can. Things like gardening, we have opened for those sites that have it, and we're just now starting to open mail rooms, trash rooms, and the salons, which have been a very hot topic. Everybody was anxious to get those opened. We felt like we'd rather have them in a controlled environment and open them on site than have people trying to go off site for them. So have been opening those as well. We just now this week actually have started bringing visitors from the for outside visits. And so we're, choreographing outside visits to some degree. We will eventually get to, we started talking about it, but we're not ready to open dining or trips or inside visitors or our common areas. Those are all shut down as well. Each site is a little bit different, as I said, and, we know we might need to change course, especially as we see what's happening across the state and in our areas. And when we get the testing in place, that may help inform things that we need to shut back down and reevaluate. A lot of communication on all of these items. We've had really great partnership from residents and families, and we do a ton of communication on all of, as we were shutting down and as we're opening up, whether it's phone calls, Zoom calls, handouts. We have a protocol that we use that we actually send out to residents that lays out each of the items as we turn it back on and what it means for them and how they can safely do that activity. So tons of communication around that. And I have to agree, I know many of you have said the same thing, the opening is much harder than the closing. There are a lot of opinions and everybody wants to have a say, and it certainly is taking a lot longer, but it's nice to bring some life back into these communities, and we're just going to try to take it slow and be methodical about it, and look forward to learning from others and what you have out there for tools as well. So that helps.
Thanks, Kim. That's great. And I think Allison put some information in the chat room and your website. It looks like some folks are having problems opening it. We're also going to send them out to everybody after this call as well. So thanks for sharing those. And we have some other plans, ones from the Quincy Housing Authority and from Colony Retirement Homes, who's on the call. So thank you to those organizations for sharing. I think this is going to be customized to what works for you. So none of us, I think, are experts on the phone. Kim and Leslie, I'm going to shoot you some questions, if that's okay. Kim, can you give us an example of what would be in your first pay, you said it was first, next, and later. Give me an example of something that's in the first, something that would be in the next, and something that would be in the later.
So in the first, things like I said, walking, and although that doesn't sound very exciting, when people were cooped up for so long, it was, we had to do a lot of coordination, especially at Jack Satterhouse, about how people were going to walk. We had to time it by floor and by unit number and what balcony people could use, and So a lot of organized walking, and then now we've done that, outside as well. The fitness staff-led groups, outdoor seating, we have returned the trash rooms, mail pickup, and again, not at all sites, but those were some of the first items that we did across the sites. We have a program called Therapy House Calls, which we were really anxious to get back. It's remote. It's basically rehab in the home. So we've modified the way we're doing that program, but we really wanted to get people moving, so we've opened that up. Then on the next list, the laundry, which we're starting to get to now, starting to open up our stores in a very modified way. I mean, everything is certainly modified. Programming, as Leslie talked about, we also have done a lot of remote programming and use of technology, but those are... we're starting to think about very small group programming as well. Then the later, as I mentioned, dining, trips, that stuff is going to come way later, and we're going to hold off on that as long as we can.
Yeah, and I think I saw, if you could, for the folks who can open the spreadsheet, things like communal dining was your high risk. How are we going to you know, you could bring, keep making meals to people, but how are you gonna bring everybody back into a communal dining? It was kind of a high risk, still needed to figure out.
Yeah, high risk, and I think it's gonna be sad. They're just gonna look very different. But we'll go.
Yep.
We'll get
there. Maybe we'll see what the restaurants do first.
Yeah.
So, and Leslie, we had a question come in, and maybe you can't speak about this specifically, but the question was about, a podiatrist who visits the site, usually wants to start doing that again. And, you know, would it be okay? Like, you know, at what point do you start thinking about vendors of any kind that were doing things that were helpful, considering that maybe that person is taking the precautions, then how do you work with them to make sure your residents are taking precautions, or how do you choreograph it? You know, I don't think there is, you both said there's no map for this, so.
Right. I mean, there's only us working with kind of property management and resident services and public health authorities to understand whether we can meet reasonable safety requirements depending on the nature of the program. So we are not at the stage where we're reopening our building to kind of visiting services at this point. I'm excited to hear about what Hebrew Senior Life is doing, because it might provide some criteria for us to start to implement that. But one thing that I want to share is that for Madison Park, we actually did a senior needs assessment a few years ago. And the reality is that only 50% of the seniors that live in our portfolio actually live in an age-restricted property. And so I think we have a twofold challenge, which is, what are the protocols that we need to implement within an age-restricted property, but also, how are we communicating with and providing resources and making sure that the seniors that live in intergenerational or family housing. And also, we have at least two multifamily buildings in our portfolio, which I refer to as naturally occurring senior housing, where there aren't age restrictions, but a majority of the population is over 55. And so we feel dually challenged in trying to think about appropriate protocols for age-restricted properties where 100% of the population is high risk, but also thinking about high risk residents that are integrated into family housing. And how are we gonna figure out the proper protocols for family housing that also addresses their needs? So I'm feeling like we have more questions than answers at this moment, but I feel like it's really important for our community to talk not exclusively about age restricted, that so many of the seniors living in our communities are in non-age restricted properties, and we have to be really thoughtful about what we're doing to address their needs and ensure their safety as part of the gradual reopening. So I just wanted to share
that. I think that's a very, very good and very valid point, and one that's hard to capture. You know, we don't really, unless we went to every property owner, it's hard to know how many people are of what age in the non-age restricted. There's a question that came in for you, specifically for you, Leslie. Mm-hmm. What do you see as the greatest challenges to the contact tracing? Do you think, is it the lack of information that you're getting from the public health folks? Is it people not receiving calls in languages they understand? Or is there something in particular that you think would be, that's a barrier?
Yeah, so, you know, I have to speak kind of secondhand from my understanding from our property management staff, but they're distinctly uncomfortable that they don't get regular calls from public health agencies. There was this expectation that if there was a positive case, that they would get some kind of notification. And affordable housing operators and owners are not currently, to my understanding, part of that communication chain. Which makes us uncomfortable, because we don't feel like we necessarily have the best handle on confirmed cases and tracing. And the other thing I would add is that, you know, our property management program and resident services staff have really close relationships with the residents, and we might be able to get them to pick up the phone when they might not respond to a public health agency or authority, and we feel disconnected from that. And so we're thinking that that's a real challenge in our community, where we can't use our relationships to enhance tracing and other opportunities by, you know, our, if generally, if we call our residents, they pick up the phone. You know, if they get a call on their cell phone with or without COVID tracing, they may not pick up the phone. So excluding affordable housing operators and owners that have relationships, we suspect is limiting our ability to really effectively trace and communicate with residents. So
I think there's been some great,
you know, discussion of this issue and trying to communicate, you know, to state and public health authorities how important it is to find ways to integrate us into that communication chain. So I just want to mention that as well.
Yeah, if both the chat room and from, I know that you're not alone, and most people are, most affordable housing folks and other housing folks are feeling a little bit, as you said, uncomfortable and I think left out of the loop. I wanted to see if anybody wanted to unmute themselves and ask a call from the phone and ask a question. I've been mostly relying on the chat room. And I would just ask, if you do unmute yourself, if you just tell us who you are, because it's hard to find you sometimes. So any questions from the folks on the phone?
Just a reminder to unmute yourself, press star six.
Hi, this is Karen Silverleaf. I'm on the board of Colony Retirement Homes. And my question is, are any of you going by your local health department instead of the state recommendations? Because it's different in different parts of the state, the higher numbers.
I would strongly, Emily, is it all right to?
I was gonna say thank you, Karen. And if you could also, both of you could just speak about your relationships with the local boards of health would be as part of that.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, I would strongly recommend, if you haven't already, that you reach out to your local board of health. They have been, for the most part, really amazing partners, and you want them to know who you are. Everything Leslie talked about, it's so true. That's such a challenge when, you know, you wanna be part of the contact tracing, you wanna be part of the information sharing back and forth. And the local boards, while we've worked with both the state and the local on some things, and you know, they interact very differently. It also depends on what activity is happening and how high the level of activity is and how overwhelmed the local board is based on how much information you'll have to and from, you know, state versus local. But locals have been really the point of contact at each site.
And Leslie, do you have a relationship in Boston with like the Boston Public Health Commission? Have they, you know, it's different in a big city, I would imagine. Have they been helpful or a partner in any of this?
So again,
and I don't want to put you on the spot to say something bad either.
I have to defer a little bit again to our property management companies that are in more routine contact, but I have been involved in city calls that included the Public Health Commission and kind of their command center, and they have invited communication with them and provided resources. You know, I'm not in a position to directly say if, you know, the on-site staff feel like that communication has been, you know, fully effective. My sense is there, like, it might be doing some things, but we have aspirations for more. Like, we were kind of hoping that we would get more guidance and information and resources on testing, on-site testing. And the reality, at least for us, is that we've started to reach out to our local community health centers to start to coordinate on-site testing. We had maybe we were being too passive, that we thought somebody was going to tell us what to do. And we're kind of realizing that in the interest of our residents, we have to be moderately more proactive in the absence of something. So I'll just share, like, that's a real-time issue where we're just, like, we're in communication both with Boston Medical Center, who is one of our medical partners, and the Whittier Community Health Center, about how do we as an owner on our particular site implement on-site testing independent of whatever, you know, coordination the local public health commission might be doing. So
I think that's very interesting and very valid, which is, you know, what do you wait to be told and what do you do? What do you take the initiative on in a whole new world? And I think probably a lot of agencies are feeling that way right now, a lot of different industries. But with this group in particular. And so it's helpful, like Kim, to share your information, like I said, we'll share some other folks as people on the phone are starting to think about what they want to do. Other people who want to unmute themselves?
Yes, I did. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Paul. You see Paul Stelzer.
Talking? Hi, everybody. It's Paul. Hi. Thank you. So a couple things. Thanks for all the information and the calls, Emily and David. I know we've communicated a lot. Thank you. We're out here in Western Mass. I'm president of Appleton Corporation. We have about 200 or 300 different residents that we deal with in one property, but totally we have about 2,000 residents that we're handling. So my comment, and it's a question, so we've just started to work with vendors to do turnovers. Everybody knows we've had the vacancy problem with nobody looking at units, people not moving in, people not moving out, but now we have third-party clients in particular, besides properties that we own, where owners are starting to push us to get the vacancies filled. So what we've done is we've created a QR code that each vendor has to scan with their phone to certify that they're symptom-free, similar to a construction site. They're pretty easy to do on Google Docs, and we are not taking temperatures because the governor lifted that restriction. If we had an outbreak in a building, we might go back to that. I echo the two speakers on your emphasis on working with your local health departments. We're in seven different towns and communities, so we've had to make relationships with everybody. But my question, so that's one thing we're doing. My question is, what are people doing about vendors and getting back to some of the interior work, particularly with respect to apartment turnovers, to start chipping away at vacancy?
So I'm going to put Kim on the spot for that one, because I think you're doing you're doing some turnover, right?
We are, and because our maintenance teams have been so overwhelmed with all of the operational components of everything we're doing, that we are having to rely on vendors, where in some areas we, you know, used to do that all that work on our own. So we are starting to bring more vendors in. I love your kind of QR code idea. That sounds, you know, we've struggled with screening. We implemented the screening process at all of our sites. It's really challenging, time consuming, labor intensive, and, you know, not sure about, I mean, it's a nice gate post, but not sure how effective certainly the temperature taking and everything is. So, but with vendors, we're you know, trying to be really careful with them. They get screened, they get education. We, you know, try to bring them in different entrances, monitor the time that they're in and out, add some monitoring to their work and their activity while they're in our building. Nothing too formal, just really trying, you know, a lot of extra effort to make sure that they're being safe and following safe practice, and certainly going through our screening that, you know, anyone else, I mean, the only other people that have been coming into our buildings have been private caregivers, essential caregivers, and so they've been going through that screening process as well.
So I think there was one last question, and then actually I want to spend a few minutes talking about the reporting bill that we mentioned on the last call, and there's been some conversations about it. So did somebody want to ask a question real quick?
Could I ask?
The last one?
Yeah, sure. May I? Yeah, Jerry Halberstadt.
Yep.
Jerry Halberstadt, Stop Bullying Coalition. I just finished up a small study looking at places that were effective at stopping bullying and mobbing. And the place that wasn't, some of the people who had been doing the mobbing were the people who were hanging around, paying no attention to, you know, masking and distancing and, you know, putting themselves at risk and everyone in the building at risk. So I think, you know, it comes down to management. I like very much the idea of partnering between staff and the public health people. I think that's an artificial barrier, but it may take an act from the governor or from the Beacon Hill, because there are regulations that prevent people from knowing this stuff. But if you want to involve tenants, which is, I think, one of the important points. If you can engage with tenants and you have this information, you can work together to prevent infections and keep people, you know, from getting sick and dying. So, and I want to applaud what I heard today is very, very helpful and very sensible approaches to difficult problems. Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for that was a nice way to sort of wrap that up. So we will be sending out to everybody after this the documents that Kim shared, some other documents that we have been given. If anyone wants to send us their stuff, we're happy to get that out as well. Again, the email is seniorhousingcovid19@mass.gov if you want to join the listserv. I'm going to switch gears for the last 5 minutes and go to Alyssa Sherman from Leading Age, Massachusetts. She spoke on our last call to tell you about a reporting bill that was at that point pending and in the past week has gotten a lot of news around that. So Alyssa, can I turn it over to you?
Yeah.
And can somebody put Alyssa's email in the chat room in case people have questions about this that they want to follow up with her?
Great, thanks, Emily. So as for those of you who were on the call last week, I mentioned legislation that had just been passed by the legislature and had been sent to the governor, which among other things, required reporting by elder care facilities, which included in the definition of elder care facilities, nursing homes, assisted living, other kinds of long-term care facilities, and also elderly housing, would have required reporting of known confirmed cases of COVID and COVID-related deaths among residents and staff to the local boards of health, as well as the Department of Public Health, and then also reporting to residents and family representatives of residents. A number of housing organizations were concerned, including Leading Age Massachusetts. I know CHAPA and others raised questions that the problem elderly housing really shouldn't be included in that definition and required to report because they often, as Leslie even explained, don't always know when there are confirmed cases. It doesn't make sense to have elderly housing reporting to the boards of health. If anything, we want the boards of health to report to the elderly housing. Had communicated to the governor. The governor did sign the bill on Sunday, so it went into effect as an emergency law, including elderly housing in that definition. However, on Tuesday this week, 2 days after he signed the bill, he then files other legislation. The governor filed legislation to make some amendments to that new law. That new law is called Chapter 93. Made some amendments to the new law, including taking elderly housing out of the definition of elder care facilities. So if this new bill passes, elderly housing would not be subject to those reporting requirements. The bill was, again, it was just introduced on Tuesday. It has been sent to the Joint Committee on Public Health, which will need to schedule a public hearing. And for those who, you know, would like to see it pass, I think it makes sense to communicate to your legislators. The bill number, for those who are interested, it's Senate Bill 2753. It does a couple of other things related to data reporting and collection and some amendments to that law. But again, the key for the purposes of elderly housing, independent housing, is it would exclude them from the reporting requirements.
So Alyssa's has her email is esherman@leadingagema.org. She is clearly the person who knows the most about these things. It seems to be moving fast, but also a little bit because of that, we're not quite sure exactly where things stand with elderly housing. I'm going to finish up today with thanking Kim and Leslie and Alyssa and Leading Age and everybody for being part of this call. The next week's call will be actually on protective services, elder protective services, and how what we have seen with regards to trends in protective services through COVID-19 and changes that protective services agencies have had to make. And then on June 25th, we're going to hear from the Boston Foundation and Tufts Health Plan Foundation about the role of philanthropy and how they have pivoted and to help be helpful in the COVID-19 world. So as always, I thank you for spending this hour with us. Good luck and stay safe in everything you're doing. So take care, everyone.